George wrote to me, the Harvard faculty voted him one of the 12 most learned people on the entire faculty. So he's a very, and you know, he's Eisenhower's scientific assistant. He was really a top physical chemist. Well, he wrote me in 1947, "Hubert, you won't believe what I'm going to teach next term." He said, "I'm going to teach a course, a terminal course in chemistry to 250 Radcliffe freshmen." He says, "I looked at the chemistry books and they're full of nonsense. I haven't had freshman chemistry for 40 years and I couldn't possibly give an exciting course using that textbook. But I remember those exciting lectures you gave at Princeton. Will you hire a secretary? I'll pay for her services," parenthesis, scientific only, "and record the experiments that you do." Well, what I did was I suddenly discovered when I came here there were maybe 200 experiments, but I had written another 500. I had 700 of them. And on a little card, I wrote each experiment. And it would say, like, exothermic reaction, it gives off heat. And then came what the assistant put out for the lecturer. A vial of a dropper bottle of mercury, a little iodine, solid iodine, a small mortar and pestle. Then the capital letters, what the professor, lecturer did, because he couldn't see very well, it had to be capital letters. And it said, take one drop of mercury, one tiny flake of iodine in the mortar, and grind it with a pestle, keeping your face at a distance, grind carefully. But it is forms mercury iodide, and it's exothermic, and the heat is enough to vaporize, and you get a little violet puff. Well, George says, "You know, Hubert, I never did the experiments before class. It wasn't giving Mother Nature a sporting chance." And the assistant would put out five cards and five chemicals for doing the sets of chemicals for doing the experiment. And I'd come in each day and say, "Well, let's see what RJ has for us today." And we'd take card number one and we'd do the experiment. If it worked, we'd examine what had happened and we'd bless you. If it didn't work, we'd curse you and spend the rest of the hour trying to make it work. And with George learning a lot of chemistry in the process. Yeah. But he says, "But I'll never forget that exothermic reaction." He said, "I took it and he says, oh, it says mercury and iodine." I said, "Oh, yeah, I didn't bother to look at the rest of it." He said, "Obviously, mercury chloride is a strong bond, mercury bromide is a weaker bond, and mercury iodide, a very weak bond, and apparently exothermic enough so the bond breaks and you get a little puff of iodine off." So he says, "I took the mercury and not one drop, but I poured it into the water. I took the iodine, I dumped the iodine in it. I says, girls, you're going to see an exothermic mineral. Boom! It exploded. It covered me head to foot with iodine. A mercury cloud went to the ceiling. 250 girls jumped to their feet in alarm. Girls, I said, you've seen an exothermic reaction. The class is dismissed." He said, "It was the shortest and the most dramatic lecture I ever gave." Well, he didn't know it, but that's changed my life completely. At that time, I was doing very exciting work on surface potentials. They're the two people who got their PhD with me, you see. And I intended to push this hard for the rest of my life, because it's very exciting. The whole surface chemistry grew out of could grow out of what I was doing. Didn't grow out of what I was doing, but could have. But I went to Belgium right after that. And those two things, I went to Hawaii right after that, 1949. And they were very excited about this and said, "Well, will you set this up for us?" So I set up all the chemicals and I rewrote these cards. And in 1950, I came back. Now I was one of the associate editors of the Journal of Chemical Education. And I thought, I ought to pull my weight in the boat. Let's publish these for the college and high school teachers. So I started the series, published them every week, every month. I published 30 of them. Because I had 700, and in the end, I published 6,000 of them. Every month, I published 30, day after day, month after year, until about 1970. Mm-hmm. So for about 20 years, I published these, constantly, and they became the tested demonstrations. Mm-hmm. Ran, I don't know, into 9 editions or something of the kind. I don't think they publish anymore now, I think. But anyway, Well, maybe they do publish. I don't know. Yeah. The Journal of Chemical Education publishes.
I think
know.
Doesn't. Well, George Gilbert took it over.
Yes, George Gilbert took it over. That's right. That's right. In fact, that George Gilbert is the one that bought this $1,170 in the front. He says, "I really have something there." He said, "I had a workshop there, mm-hmm. and they've tried it, and they really think it's very useful." Yeah. So, anyway, so that's right. So George Gilbert is doing it now. Fred Dutton did it. In 1970, I gave it over for the projection stuff, mm-hmm. and Fred Dutton took it over. And then they began to publish Allier and Dutton Tested Demonstration as a book form, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, now we come to the tested overhead projection part of it. Mm-hmm. Then, now this was 1950 to 1958. 1958, and that was because of George Kitsikowski that I did this, you see. In 1958, I went to Belgium for 9 months to lecture on atomic energy mostly, but I had about 10 lectures I gave. I gave them 6 lectures a day, 6 days a week, and about 200 people came in for each lecture. It was the International Pavilion. It wasn't the American Pavilion. I was one of the exhibits. And I went over and superintended the building of it, actually, in January. I know how to build a pretty good ladder. What I did was, they wanted to have a platform for the speaker to stand on. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to be with the people, right on the ground with them. And so I used the curved apron of the platform as my lecture table. Yeah. And then I turned around and faced the people and had a little table for doing the experiments. Mm-hmm. And it made a wonderful thing. And I did the same out in Seattle. I went out and supervised the building of it, went out there too. Mm-hmm. Well, when I wasn't lecturing to the people, I was wanting to do some research. I tell teachers, always do research. You're going to be a good teacher. Always keep your finger in the pie. Otherwise, you'll get stale in 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do the surface potential because it's very elaborate material. But I used to project on the wall. I talk in French, compound fractured French. I used to project on the wall, and then my assistant, when I'd say to him, "Le carbone est noir," he'd say in Dutch, "Le koolstof is zwart." He'd say the Dutch because they're Flemish people, mm-hmm. you see. And then every time I said a phrase, he would say something. Well, finally I thought, you know, I think I'll have an overhead projector with it on, and I had pink cellophane and yellow cellophane over the thing. So up on the top was in French, Le Carbone Noir, mm-hmm. and in yellow, Corsair de Schwartz. Mm-hmm. So the Dutch all read the yellow, and the French all read the pink, you see. And so when I wasn't doing that, I thought, why can't I project these experiments? Well, the reason you can't project them is that the overhead projector is horizontal. Mm-hmm. And your macro experiments are all vertical, your stills and everything. And I said, if I could only make a projector with a vertical stage, then everything would do that. And that's what I did. And I ended up with, now you've heard of Erlenmeyer's, haven't you? Mm-hmm. You've heard of Florence's, haven't you?
That's right.
But you've never heard of an Allier before. That's an Allier. Actually, not nearly as good as the original ones. The $12,000 now, mold burned up. And I have to make these, I have these extrude and cement this on myself, which is a nuisance. But the other one looked much more professional. Mm-hmm. But you do all your experiments in that, either projection or individual. I'll come to that later. So you put that on the stage of your overhead projector, and you project up on the wall. In fact, you've probably seen me project, have you, or no?
Oh, yes.
You haven't, so this is what it is. I have a projector adapter now. You put that on the stage of any overhead projector, mm-hmm. and the light comes up and hits a mirror here, hits this mirror, it comes up through the lenses, hits this mirror, and then goes up on there. And so up on the wall, you will see this thing be 10 feet tall. If I have 1,000 people, as I have often in the audience, they'll see a test tube 10 feet tall, and with test tubes in it, holds 4 test tubes, and you do everything in it, you see. And so that was in 1958, and so by the time I came back from the fair, I had pretty much decided that maybe I would do projection of experiments for the rest of my life instead of the surface potentials. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't sure, and I asked the NSF to give me, they gave me $6,000. And I worked for And by the end of 4 months, I was sold. I said, "This is, I'm really an inventor rather than a chemist." Mm-hmm. And I said, "This is exactly the kind of thing that I'm good at, and I should do more of it." Mm-hmm. And so I said to them, "Now, from now on, we'll do it." And so that's when they gave me a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I had a workshop with 50 people here one summer, all working on these. Mm-hmm. And we published 1,000 projection experiments. Now, this takes the 20 best, the 200 best. Mm-hmm. And you do all the experiments. I'll get to that in a minute. And so that's how the tested demonstrations graduated into the overhead projection. Mm-hmm. And since it's called tested demonstration, you call this one fun, tested overhead projection series. And that became TOPS.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've always been impressed with how imaginatively you can show different reactions in these, in the Allier cells.
Yeah, for example, this was, now you're not only, all the time I was doing that, And these from 1960 to 1970, I think it was 72 to 71, mm-hmm. In the 1960s, in other words, I had in the back of my mind, but I want the individual student to do it. Mm-hmm. And so by 1970, I graduated to the armchair chemistry, and now we have it, and that's your. This has been translated into Japanese indentally, and they have it, and then they have, it's all in Japanese, but this, and right on here in English, an armchair. Because the Japs wouldn't know what an armchair was. And you sit there, and you sit, do all the experiments there. Now, the projection things, for 39 years, cost Princeton $1,000 a year for chemicals, just the projection, not the lab experiment, $1,000 a year for chemicals, and about $4,000 a year for the assistant. You get $10,000 a day, but $4,000. So about $5,000 a year for 39 years. When Dave McPherson retired, and I had 3 years left, I said, "Don't do it anymore. I've perfected this projection. I'll do it this way from now on." I did the same experiments. It took me 15 minutes on Monday to get ready for the entire week's experiments, about 25 experiments or more. And it cost the university, so they say $4,000 to begin with, 15 minutes on Monday to prepare and lay away all the experiments for the week. And it cost the university not $1,000 for chemicals, but $10 a year for chemicals. Hmm. And so I went all over the world, around 80 countries, 13 times around the world, showing all these countries how to use it. And then it was actually published in India for a while, so they could buy it from there, and show them how to make the projector and how to carry out the experiments on it. And for example, here you can see the armchair chemistry. If you're going to just heat something, it's in there. You see, there's your gas generator. On the other hand, not if you're going to heat something. It puts zinc and acid in there, and then it comes off, and then you lower your gas collector over here, you see, and it bubbles up through the water, and then you stop it, and you catch the gas, then you test it, you see. And the entire laboratory is in this box. That is a complete chemical laboratory. You need absolutely nothing else. No Bunsen burners, no test tubes, absolutely nothing. That's all the student uses, not even paper clips and rubber bands or pieces of paper. That's the whole book is written. So that's all he uses, see.
Something.
And now if you wanted to heat something, then you do this. I just did this hurriedly, so I'm not sure it may break off, because I don't think it will. Now you're going to heat something, so you put it there, put this there, put this here, there. And, here's my test tube clamp. Everything has to be very, very inexpensive. If it isn't, I won't use it. That's a test, and then you put your heater under here, you see. You lower it to it.
Yeah.
Now you heat it, you see. And when the gas comes off, you put it down there and you catch it, see. And there are other things. There's something like this you can use. You can put this down. You can put this down with a little extension tube, so it fits over that. and suck the liquid up. Now you can measure rate of reaction of the gas coming off and so on, this way. And so, and the thermometer, everything you think that you have to do in a freshman chemistry laboratory. And I have actually had as many as 300 people in the Frick laboratory working for 3 hours doing these experiments. When the assistant was away and I was alone, I said, well, let's do it armchair stuff. So, but for 7 years, I used this with my non-science students. And the first term, they would do this. Armchair chemistry, and learned a whole lot of chemistry from it.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, following each other, there were questions, and the answers were there. So it's sort of self-propagating thing. And then the second term, these non-science students went downstairs, still use only this equipment, no other equipment, and for the whole second term, they invented their own experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked in pairs, and they would come in to me early, at the beginning of the term, and I'd spend 8 minutes with each pair, and they have a list of 5 experiments they think they might do, and I'd say, well, do number 2, that's very good. I think that'll take you the whole term. But do number 3 and 5, I'll probably take you. Number 1, 2, and 4, they're little things, you can get those done in a year.
Mm-hmm.
In January, I said to the assistant, the 2 assistants in the lab, get out of here, I'm going to make the chemicals for the entire term for 60 people. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I had made all the reagents and all the chemicals for 60 people, and we didn't have to go into the stockroom once from January till May. Because they were doing various different experiments, and they had all these bottles out, and they only used drops, you see, so they only used very little. And so that's the second term. And that's when the old Nassau orange and black was invented.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was going to take the orange, the thing that turns black, and he's going to have the effect of catalysts and inhibitors. And he put mercury in, and he came over and he says, Doc, instead of turning black, as it usually does, it's turning bright orange. I said, well, you expected, friends, a 50-50 chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized it was mercuric iodide was forming instead of the iodine clock. I had to go back and cut down on the mercury, and cut it down, cut down. We cut down to about 1/20th. And they go, it turns orange, it turns black. Well, then I announced to the class, and there are now 140 guys that spent all the rest of that 3 hours doing the old Nassau reaction. And I called it the old Nassau reaction historically for a very interesting reason. 4 reasons. Of course, Nassau Hall is the mecca of Princeton students. They're going back to Nassau Hall, the best old place of all. Reason number 1. Reason number 2 was that the Battle of Princeton was the turning point of the Revolution. Wertenbaker points this out. It's a very important time because up until then, the Dutch farmers and German farmers in the Philadelphia area had not backed Washington, but when he defeated the British, they came forward with food and clothing. And the ammunition was stored in Nassau Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And when Washington came up, he came up to get it from Nassau Hall. So that's the second reason. Now the third reason is the first telegraph message historically ever sent by man, do you know when? Where? Was sent from Nassau Hall to the Henry House.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Henry, who is a professor of physics, dean, I guess, I'm not sure if he's dean or not, had 2 wires running from the dean's office in Nassau Hall over. Maybe it's the McLean. Is there a Henry House, a McLean House, or no?
I think it was the McLean House.
It's the McLean House.
And the
wires ended in a huge magnet, which is actually on display in the physics building here still. He brought that, now he wound the magnet up at Albany, where he taught, and he brought it down to Princeton when he came down.
Mm-hmm.
And that huge magnet, he later became first. Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution,
yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
And that wire ran from his office in Nassau Hall over to the kitchen. And when he's coming home for tea at 4 o'clock, he touched the 2 wires together and the magnet would click. And when they heard it click, they meant the master's coming home, put the water on for tea. Not what hath gone wrong. That was another one. And so that Nassau Hall was important for that. And that was at least 2 years before Morse patented the telegram. And he admitted, Morse admitted he got the idea from the Princeton professor.
Hmm.
And his great-granddaughter, lived next to her in Montclair, and I used to tease her that she got rich because her old grandfather stole ideas from Princeton professors. So that's another reason. But the real reason that I call it the old Nassau reaction is that Nassau Hall is, and I hope you can check on this, Jeff, so far as I know, the oldest college undergraduate chemistry laboratory in the world. Now let me tell you the history of this. There is no question it's the oldest in the colonies. John McLean, I've tried to go over there and find these records, but he was supposed to have a list of equipment. We may find it sometime. I went to the archives and tried it, but I never did quite find it. He was supposed to send a list of equipment that students should bring with them to Princeton. I think it was 1797. Mm-hmm. He came, I think, in 1795 or 96, perhaps. And there were only two professors of chemistry in the New World, you know, John McLean at Princeton and Benjamin Rush. In Pennsylvania.
That's right, Benjamin Rush.
Those were only two. All the others were professors of natural philosophy. Mm. Harvard, William and Mary, and the other did not have professors of chemistry. And John McLean only held that chair for 1 year, and then he was promoted to professor of natural philosophy. But for 1 year, he was professor of chemistry, and he had the students in the catalog, so Foster told me, but I never could find it. He had a list of equipment the students should bring with them when they came to Princeton to carry out these experiments. Hmm. Now, in 1803, Benjamin Solomon introduced laboratory in the freshman course up at Yale and said that he got the idea from John McLean in Princeton. So there's no question that we antedated Yale. Harvard and William and Mary were back, I know exactly in which order, between 1808 and 1810 introduced it. And so I don't think there's any question that it was the first undergraduate chemistry laboratory in the colonies. Mm-hmm. Now we come, why in the world? Because they didn't have undergraduate courses in chemistry, they had apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. You see, Faraday said his greatest discovery was Davy said his greatest discovery was Michael Faraday, because when Faraday brought up his lecture notes, his own press, he had Faraday come and wash dishes. And I've asked about this whenever I've gone abroad. The oldest I can find is the University of Edinburgh, mm-hmm. and that was 1818. Hmm. So Edinburgh is 1818. At least that's what they told me. Whether how authentic, I don't know. But nobody that I've known in Germany or France has ever claimed that they had a college course in chemistry that antedated 1797.
Yeah. I can't think of any undergraduate college laboratory.
Right? Yeah,
I can think of, there were plenty of chemistry professors
in 1797.
And all the rest.
So that's why I called it the old Nassau reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's a delightful reaction. I like watching it. And it does have a fairly complicated chemistry.
Somebody should study it a little more to find out. It can turn yellow and black instead of orange and black. And the question of concentrations and temperature.
Yeah. Has that ever happened to you in your life?
Oh, yes, every once in a while. I wear suspenders and also a bell. I do it twice. And if it fails the second time, I always have the orange over there, and it turns black and stays black, and say, orange and black. And it's supposed to be that.
They'll
see. Oh, we learned to cover up. Now, let me tell you one other thing about the armchair chemistry. Let's see. Oh, the other thing is that with this new book, this... every decade something new. 1950 was a tested demonstration. 1960 was projection. 1970 was the armchair chemistry. 1980 or 82, one or two, was the teacher's handbook. Now the teacher's handbook tells the teacher on any particular day what chemicals to take out. See, for example, suppose the teacher, you set up about 100 chemicals. It took me one day to do it myself, to get the chemicals ready. All the labels and for the chemicals and so on are here, and how to make them up and so on. So the TH makes up all these different solutions and puts them out, and now they're ready for the entire year. In other words, in August, the teacher works one day, I worked less than a day, and now has all reagents, has nothing else to read. That was the trouble with chem study. It was made for the upper 15% of the class. When we were in Taiwan and wanted to set up the chem study stuff, I consulted for both chem bond and chem study, so I have nothing to pick with it. There were 2,000 solutions to make up for chem study, because the people who made it up had plenty of assistants in the laboratory and didn't realize that the average high school teacher just doesn't have that much of them. But suppose number 22 is thermochemistry. Mm-hmm. Well, the teacher has to go and get those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bottles down off the shelf. Mm-hmm. She now has 3 hours of lab for the kids to do. Mm-hmm. And each kid has a set of bottles and a set of solutions. Here they are. It has a set of bottles. Mm-hmm. And this holding vials for 20 milliliters and tested for less. And a tray and a slop pole and thing. And that each kid has that. And it may be that they only use 5 dropping bottles. It may be they use 1 dropping bottle and 1 vial, and maybe, for example, suppose they're going to add bicarbonate soda and add a drop of vinegar. Well, they only take a mini spoonful, a 20th of a teaspoonful of it in there, so they use a minimum amount of chemicals. Mm-hmm. They take that before they ever sit down. And once they sit down, they have all the chemicals for the entire 3 hours or hour of dinner. Yeah. They're not running up and getting the things and so on. Yeah. So 1950 was tested demonstration, 1970 was projection, 1980 was this. I don't know what 1990 is.
Well, we'll be interested to
Instead of composing, I'll be decomposing.
One thing you started to tell us about last week was the work you did for the state of New Jersey with gas defense in World War II, and also the teaching, the industrial courses and graduate courses around the state.
Now, what happened was that they set up a civil defense, and in the chain of command, they had somebody called a senior gas officer. And Princeton released me for 2 days a week on this. Mm-hmm. And I lined up people, and we had regular meeting in 5 different places regularly with them. And I learned a lot about it. I had 3 secretaries down there, and I would dash away. I finished lecturing at 11:30, and I had to be back at 1:30 to my lab. Mm-hmm. I dashed down there, and they're all sitting poised ready to, and the phone would ring, and they could call me, these gas officers could tell me, between, I don't forget what it was, let's say 12:15 and 12:45. Mm-hmm. And the phone would ring. And I had all these on a card file. And I threw all the correspondence. They were horrified. Everybody kept 3 copies of everything. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a copy of anything. I'd say, Joe Blokes, Walnut Hill, wants 5 gas masks. His wife, his kid has broken her elbow or something. Well, months later, he'd call up. I want to get some. Oh, you want to get some more? Add to those 5 you got. Oh, you remember I had 5? Oh, sure, I remember everything. How's your kid's elbow? You remember that? They didn't know that. Joe Blokes said, Joe Blokes. She quickly get the car and hand up to me. So I learned that you could take reams of letters and boil them down to 1 single line those 2 or 3 years. And then, so here, and so we had these meetings. And they set up
one second.